A third term for Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan. Economic problems at home and balancing East-West relations are just two of the urgent challenges he faces. So what does Erdogan's re-election mean for Turkey and for the wider world? This is Inside Story. Hello and welcome to the program. I'm Fully Batibo. It went to a runoff after a very tight first round, but Recep Tayyip Erdogan has emerged the clear winner of Turkey's presidential election. After overcoming probably the biggest political challenge he's ever faced, he will hope his third term will further tighten his grip on power. Opponents have expressed dismay, with the poll results starkly reflecting deep political divisions in the country. A key player between East and West, Turkey's relations are complex, such as the NATO member also being on good terms with Russia. We'll be exploring what Erdogan's re-election may mean for the country shortly. But first, Hashim Ahilbara in Ankara tells us what some of the most pressing issues are.
Now that he has been re-elected and secured a comfortable majority of the parliament, the next 5 years will be a defining moment for President Recep Tayyip Erdogan. But he will continue to face a wide range of issues, such as the economy, which has been declining over the last few years. And on this, many experts expect a return to economic orthodoxy, where he should give the central bank a give a say in the future. He will also need to rebuild entire cities devastated by the earthquake, something which is going to cost him $100 billion. To do that, he will have to build bridges with the US and the EU. His ties with the international community have strained over the last few years, but he is giving indications that he is willing to mend fences, particularly when he ratified Finland's bid to join NATO, widely seen as a sign that he wants stronger relations with the West in exchange for more financial support to be able to fix the economy and to rebuild the cities that were devastated by the earthquake. President Recep Tayyip Erdogan told his people that now he's looking forward to move forward and unify everyone who voted for him or voted for the opposition. We'll have to wait and see whether he will be able to deliver on all those promises. For Inside Story, Hashim Ahilbara, Al Jazeera.
Well, let's take a closer look at the challenges President Erdogan faces as he begins his new term in office. Turkey's economy is in crisis, with its people struggling with a high cost of living. The Turkish lira has lost nearly 340% against the US dollar during the 5 years of President Erdogan's last term. And inflation is running at more than 50%. Critics blame Erdogan for refusing to raise interest rates. The president also faces the huge task of uniting a deeply polarized nation. The opposition has criticized his government for its stance on Syrian refugees. Erdogan has accused his rival of siding with Kurdish fighters that his party regards as terrorists. Millions of people in the southwest of Turkey are still living in makeshift homes after two devastating earthquakes in February. President Erdogan has promised to prioritize rebuilding in those areas. Now, with Erdogan's victory, Turkey's foreign policy is also in the spotlight. NATO members are hoping Ankara will allow Sweden into the military alliance. Turkey has blocked Sweden's application. Erdogan says the country hasn't met all of Turkey's demands. Turkey is described as the bridge between Europe and the Middle East, but its relations with Russia have unsettled Western powers. It has close ties with Moscow, but also provides military aid to Ukraine. Turkey's foreign policy over the years has expanded its global influence. It's intervened militarily across the Middle East, Africa and Europe. Last year, Ankara helped broker a deal that ended Russia's blockade on Ukraine grain supplies. Well, let's bring in our guests now for today's Inside Story. In Istanbul is Helene Sari Artem, Associate Professor of International Relations at Istanbul Medeniyet University. In Peterborough is Ben Harris, Founder and Editor-in-Chief of BNE Intelli News. And in Istanbul as well is Onur Erim, political advisor and president of Dragoman Strategies. A warm welcome to all three of you. Thank you so much for joining us on Inside Story. Onur, in Istanbul, let me start with you, please. In his victory speech, President Erdogan called for unity and solidarity. With 48% of Turks voting for change, how is he going to unite such a polarized country? Will he extend an olive branch to the opposition?
Well, I mean, his speech, which is now known to be as his balcony speech, did start with, you know, expressions of that he will need everyone's support and everyone coming together to achieve the goals of the next century, as he pretty much, you know, labeled Turkey as next motto going into the second 100 years of the Turkish Republic. As far as the numbers that he has gotten, do realize that in the last two presidential elections, 2014 and 2018, this is not much difference except for maybe a decimal or two for Erdogan. The 52-48 split has been there at least since 2014.
How is he going to bring those 48% of Turks who didn't vote for him on board?
Well, first of all, the first two rounds, the first two times, there were no second round, there were no runoffs. I mean, the first one, the second one wasn't. Listen, he has been battling politically against everybody in Turkey, all the entire opposition, which are you know, they're like day and night. Most of these guys that got together under Kılıçdaroğlu's candidacy, they got together just to get rid of Erdogan. I think he was battling against everybody else. He still, in the first round, was able to, you know, surpass Kılıçdaroğlu by almost 5 points, which is pretty much about 4 points now, more than close to 2.5 million votes, just over 2 million votes this time. Mm-hmm. So I don't know if you can call that polarization, okay. You know, because most of the presidential races in countries with presidential systems, this is basically, I mean, you would probably consider this a landslide if it was in the U.S.
Okay.
So I think we should stop.
Yeah. Helene, what are your thoughts on this? Onur says this isn't a country that's polarized necessarily and that President Erdogan's victory is a decisive one. It is decisive. If it's not polarized, do you share that point, first of all, that this is not a polarized country? And how does Erdogan unite Turks today?
Well, it is a polarized country, unfortunately, and this trend is a global trend. So Turkey is not the only example in which polarization is getting higher and higher. We see the same trend in the United States. We see a similar trend in most of the European countries as well, inside their own societies. Actually, people are trying to decide about the fate, about their fate, about their future way of living. And in terms of this perspective, we see that Turkish society is somehow split into two, because one side is quite secular and liberal and the other side is quite conservative as well as nationalist. We have seen and witnessed a huge rise of Turkish nationalism, especially in this last couple of weeks, in the first and second round of the presidential elections, and especially President Erdogan's policy for this election was mainly based on Turkish nationalism. Right. I'm not sure whether the half of the Turkish society, I mean the opposition part, is feeling themselves as Turkish nationalists that much, because the narratives that Erdogan and his party is using is mainly taking its root from history, from Ottoman past, from the concurrence of Istanbul, from the past coup d'etat in 2060. So it's mainly about a conservative past as well as a very Turkish nationalist past.
Okay. Before I bring in Ben into the conversation, Onur, I'm going to allow you to respond to what Helene just said and also ask you about what President Erdogan is going to be now towards, his policy is going to be towards the nationalists. And he reached out to them during the campaign, of course. Is that trend going to continue?
Well, you have to realize his number one supporter politically is the nationalist MHP party, who's the second oldest party in Turkey. He has been collaborating with them under the same coalition for at least 6-7 years. And there's all the indications that he will continue. So I don't think there's going to be any difference in approach as far as he's concerned, his policies are concerned, when it comes to, you know, feeling very close to of those nationalist views. And as I said, I think polarization is really mistaken in Turkey as opposed to anywhere else. People here, as soon as the race is over, the elections are over, people just are going about their ways. Let's not, you know, mistake the wars going on in social media between the parts or the polarized parts, as they call, with the regular public. More than half my family is extremely opposed to Erdogan. A lot of my friends are. We have no problem. This is, when you talk about polarized political sides in Turkey, I don't think it's the same thing as most outside of Turkey would understand to be
so. Let's get Ben's thoughts on this. Ben, do you expect now a much more conciliatory tone and approach from President Erdogan now that the election is over? Will he be more focused on uniting the country?
I don't think so. I mean, Erdogan is all about power. And if you watch his career, as he rose, set up the AK Party that has just won his party, but that was based in Islam conservative values. And we've been talking about here polarization. I think it's better to describe it as a divided country, and it's symptomatic of its place in Europe. I mean, right on the edge, and half the country is looking east to the Arab world, and the other half is looking to Europe. And I think it's notable that, you know, Erdogan has led this sort of conservative Islamic nationalistic tainted campaign, whereas the opposition, the Republican People's Party, I mean, this is the party of Atatürk, the founder of the modern state, and it was very much he committed Turkey to liberal secular state. My correspondents in Turkey, Vox Pop, young people, young professional liberals, and they're looking to the West, they're looking to Europe, and many of them said that if a country continues to go down this increasingly conservative path, that they would leave, they would up sticks and go. And I think that's the issue here, is that it's not polarized so much, it's divided between these two different ideas of where the country should go. And the country just voted in Erdogan, which means it's going to go down that more socially conservative, more religious orientated line than it had done before. So the reconciliation is trying to bring those two parts together. They don't really fit.
Right. Okay, so two different ideas, you say, Ben, of where to take Turkey. Let me come to you now, Onur, and talk about the immediate challenges, domestic challenges that President Erdogan faces. And that is, of course, the struggling Turkish economy, one of them, the main one. What are we going to see in terms of economic policy? Will we see a U-turn from President Erdogan on some of his more controversial economic policies to deal with the skyrocketing inflation?
Well, you could say a lot of things about President Erdogan. One thing you got to give him, though, he's a leader. He's a political figure that actually is keeps a very good beat of the public, of the citizens. So if he has to change things around, if he deems so, he will do it right away. Right now, it's no, of course, secret that the Turkish economy has been under heavy fire, you know, especially from the West. And that it has been, you know, it has its own issues that's been going along for a long time. But the thing is, despite all of these, despite the big war right next to us, despite the troubling economy in especially in Western Europe, which is our biggest export partner, and despite the fact that the USA is really struggling financially, I think Turkey is holding its own pretty good now. How long can we last, and how long can he get this going? We will have to see. But for sure, he is definitely has definitely promised for better days economically for the entire Turkish population.
Better days economically. Are we going to see him change his policy on these low interest rates?
I don't think so.
Okay.
I don't think so. And he's actually and there is a lot of you know, despite the very heavy. You know, media against him on this. There's actually a lot of papers coming out, as it has been before, trying, you know, maybe questioning what he was doing was wrong while everybody was raising interest rates for him to lower the interest rates. But as I said, this is a very debatable issue. I could go on for hours and hours.
Let's hear from Ben, who wanted to jump in on that. Ben, What do you think about the economic policies? Will we see him deviate from these unorthodox, what some would say unorthodox policies he's had on the economy?
Unorthodox is a massive understatement. He's convinced, he said in an interview with Bloomberg, that if you lower interest rates at the central bank, then you bring inflation down, which flies in the orthodoxy because it's the other way around. And you mentioned that Turkey's got 50% inflation. We think those numbers are highly massaged and that it's much higher. And yet he's reduced, or the central bank has reduced interest rates by 500 basis points, 5%. Which is insane. So the currency has gone from 3 lira to the dollar down to 20 now, and the analysts are saying that there's going to be another, now the elections are over, and now the central bank's going to let go of some of the controls because it has to. There's going to be another 25% devaluation. Yeah. And at the same time, the reserves have virtually run out because they've been trying to hold the lira stable before the elections. And at the same time, Turkey's running a whopping $50 billion a year trade deficit, and this is all unsustainable. So Turkey is headed, or is in, a massive economic crisis already. It's just not manifest itself.
Helene, there are indeed concerns that the Turkish central bank can't continue to prop up the lira. President Erdogan has said he is the one who can deal with this economic crisis. Do you believe that?
Well, we can I think assume that the Turkish society, as the majority of, part of it, actually bought this statement and underlined their support for Erdogan, that he is the one who is going to solve every kind of problem. And as well, also, we also have to understand that the most of the society also thinks that, yeah, the economy is bad, we have problems, but at the same time, he's the cure. And so opposition couldn't change this idea about Erdogan. There's a huge trust on him as the strong man. And we also have to underline that the big cities are different from the other local parts of Anatolia, and the main parts of the votes are coming from Anatolia, small cities, local places, in which the people are not suffering as much as those people living in big cities, regarding the high inflation, regarding the high rent, and so on. For that reason, we can assume that President Erdogan's main support is coming from Anatolia, not the big cities, metropoles like Istanbul, Ankara, and Izmir. There will be problems. There will be a hard time ahead of us. Everybody accepts that. The only difference between the opposition and Erdogan's supporters is that the people, majority, who are supporting Erdogan, are ready to suffer much more just to save him as the leader, because most of these people are also thinking that this is a kind of a Western game being played against Turkey. High inflation is a part of this anti-Turkey rhetoric.
Right.
As President Trump in the past, for example, he used the sentence that he has the ability to play with Turkish economy just with a tweet. For that reason, many of the people are thinking that this is actually a responsibility of the West, and and Erdogan is the right person to solve.
Okay. Before we talk about what we can expect on the international stage, I wanted to touch on the issue of the Syrian refugees. And Onur, come to you about this. President Erdogan has promised to send back 1 million Syrians over the next few years. Is this feasible? Is this possible? Or was that just campaign rhetoric?
He actually said he will set the stage, a livable, humane stage, for 1 million people to go back to Syria. And as it was just announced, I think a couple of weeks before the elections, there was a deal or a collaboration, I should say, rather, made with the state of Qatar to build, you know, housing and all the social surroundings of it for 1 million refugees to go back to at least the controlled and the safe part of Syria. So, yes, he said he never used the word he will send them back. He always is very careful about that. He said he will set the stage and give all the necessary, make sure that all the necessary things are done for them to go back willingly. And that's really the difference between Erdogan and everybody else.
Ben, your thoughts about the issue of Syrian refugees. Presumably, the Europeans are happy that Erdogan is still in power because he's been able to deal with the Syrian refugee crisis and perhaps not allow the refugees to get into the European Union. How do you see this evolving now that he's been re-elected?
Well, he's been very pragmatic. He's been using it as a card. I mean, the reason why the Europeans were happy that they didn't turn up in Europe was that Europe paid billions of dollars in order for him to keep them. And in that sense, he's become very transactional. In a lot of his foreign relations, he's become transactional about what he can get out of it. And he uses the issue of the refugees as a card that he can play in order to extract concessions from Europe in the form of cash. In the Middle East, there's a reconciliation going on rapidly at the moment that Iran and Saudi Arabia have just mended fences after 9 years of no diplomatic relations. The same thing with Syria itself. It's just been readmitted to the Arab League.
Right.
And so here he has these million refugees that Sakari can play with that. And I think he's going to be very careful about it. But he definitely, because of his relatively poor relations with Europe, in the sense that he's been trying to get EU and he's never been able to do it, that he's also looking to the East, the Middle East as well, in order to...
Who has the upper hand right now, Ben? Sorry to interrupt you, but who has the upper hand now in the relationship between Turkey and the EU? And is he still interested in getting to the European Union, given the strained relations we've seen?
Well, they were granted in, what was it, late 1989 and 1999, given candidate status, and they've been left in the waiting room ever since. And I think he said in 2017 he's basically given up on it, because Merkel herself, German Chancellor, stood up and said Turkey will never get in. So I think it's clear it's not. But EU remains a major market, and Turkey's very interested in that. So he wants to maintain those good relations. But at the same time, there's non-aligned thing going on that's being led by China and Russia, and he's also interested in doing that. And I think he sees himself in the middle of the spider's web with good relations to the West, good relations to the East, and good relations with the Middle East as well.
Right.
So, I mean, again, the refugee issue is a card to play in that game.
Okay, Helene, let me ask you about the relationship now with the East and West. President Erdogan has got one foot in NATO, but he's also got one foot turned towards Moscow, towards Russia. Is this a position that's tenable in your view?
Yeah, this will continue, and this is in total harmony with Turkey's traditional foreign policy approach. It's a balancing act since the very beginning of the Republic. For that reason, especially in the last couple of years, we observed that Erdogan and his party is going through a kind of rapprochement with many of the neighboring countries, including Syria. We are getting closer with Egypt, with the Gulf countries, with United Arab Emirates, Saudi Arabia, even Greece in the West. And this rapprochement will continue because this is quite beneficial for Turkey. Economically, we need this rapprochement with the neighboring countries. And as well as this, also this is very important to improve Turkey's soft power, which was lost to a great extent with the increase of the hard power, especially in Syrian civil war. I also expect that there will be a kind of handshaking between Erdogan and Assad in Syria. And I think if Turkey can manage that, the problem of Syrian refugees will also be solved quite clearly, quite easily, by sending them back after a rapprochement with the Assad regime.
Okay. Onur Elin says she expects a handshaking between Erdogan and Syria's Assad very soon. What about the relationship with Washington, D.C., and NATO also? I mean, one of the point of tensions with NATO has been Turkey agreeing for Sweden to join the military alliance. Do you see that happening? And how does the relationship with Biden now move forward?
Well, I'm just throwing a little fact to a previously made, to me, a very unjustified comment that Turkey is being made look like she is... sort of using this as a card against Europe to get money. Turkey only received just over $6 billion from the European Union. In exchange, Turkey has spent more than $45 billion on the Syrian refugees. So to call Turkey holding this as a stake against Europe to get money is first, unbased, and secondly, very unjust. Going back to what happens with NATO, I guess when you say NATO, we're really talking about the United States. I don't know. Biden has to decide. No one has really come up to date as to why Biden and, to a degree, Trump in his last year or two was so hostile against Turkey. No one has really come up with an answer or an explanation as to why Turkey was not delivered the F-35s that it was that she paid for, or no one was able to explain why Turkey was ousted from the F-35 program, you know, once as single-sidedly without any reason, and against all the you know, contracts that has been signed. So I think what happens next between the relationship, the Turkish-American relationship, really depends on how the Biden administration and the United States government acts. I think the burden is upon them to make the next move.
What about the accession of Sweden to NATO, Onur? Will President Erdogan now accept to ratify Sweden's accession now that the election is over?
Look, it's no secret that these are mostly political decisions. But Erdogan put, you know, in the beginning, put a very straightforward, you know, statement out there that the internationally recognized terrorist organizations, they do something about it, that he will continue. And if they don't, if they, you know, continue to harbor these terrorists, who are, you know, maybe some are not accepted as terrorists everywhere, but some are. Right. Erdogan said he will not move. But having said that, I do understand that these are more political decisions than anything else.
Okay. Ben, I'll give you the last word and allow you to respond to Onur, who was saying that it's not right to call Turkey's relationship with the EU transactional, and also get your thoughts about the future of the relationship with Washington and Russia at the same time.
Well, all complicated issues. I mean, I see it as transactional in the sense that, you know, with the issue of Sweden's membership of NATO, that Turkey rolled over and accepted Finland straight away. But as my colleague was saying, you know, there's these the Kurdish People's Party, the PKK, and they are a lot of those guys who have taken refuge in Sweden. And Erdogan's made it very clear that you need to, A, lift the sanctions that were imposed on us about 5 years ago, and B, you need to extradite these guys who we claim or believe or see as terrorists. Sweden went as far as putting through a new terrorist law, which comes into effect on June 1st. And my understanding of it is that Ankara is waiting to see the effect of that and whether if any of these guys, PKK guys, are extradited back to Turkey before he goes ahead and takes off the agrees to NATO's Sweden joining NATO. As for Washington, I mean, yeah, the issue with the fighter jets, the US-made fighter jets, has also been a thorn in the side and haven't been sent. But again, that's part of the problem with that was it was scuppered because Erdogan agreed to buy this S-400 anti-missile system from Russia, which is non-NATO, and the Americans took great exception to that. And this is what's ended up as a between those two things. And it's an example both of Erdogan playing both sides. It's also an example of him wanting to develop his own military capacity and not be totally dependent on NATO. And Washington, in that sense, don't see Turkey as a team player, although it's part of the alliance. And Erdogan sits in the middle, playing both sides every time. And this is what's in a lot of trouble.
We're going to have to leave it there. Obviously, there's still a lot of ground to cover in this conversation, but we'll leave it there for today. Thank you so much to all three of you for joining us on Inside Story. Helene Sari, Artem, Onur Erim, and Ben Aris. Thank you. And thank you as well for watching. You can always watch this program again anytime by visiting our website at aljazeera.com. For further discussion, go to our Facebook page. That's facebook.com/AJInsideStory. And of course, you can join the conversation on Twitter. Our handle is at AJInsideStory. From me, Fuliba Thibault, and the whole team here in Doha, thanks for watching. Bye for now.